At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Ken D. Foster. I'm talking with Dr. Bernie Siegel today, and we're talking about how you can heal pretty much anything if you start to learn some of the principles that Doctor is teaching us, and that's what the show's about, so I'm glad you're here with us.
My furry book,
2025.
I didn't write.
Yeah.
I talked for days and then got it typed out and turned into a book. And the truth is, you see, again, I'd say it's back to parts of my brain. The only C I got in 4 years of college was in creative writing. And my sense of humor, after I wrote a best-selling book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, I wrote my college. I said, would you please raise my grade to a B now that I have this book, and then I'll have high honors. Whenever my name appears, that will be with it, instead of now just saying I have lower, level honors. And the school wrote back, I expected a laughter from the school. And instead, I got three or four pages of serious, information about how we cannot alter grades after graduation. And I wrote them and said, I feel sorry for you guys. I thought you'd end up laughing. Instead, you're also serious, telling me what I can't do. But I really felt that my brain, the left side, was damaged.
Yeah.
And I became, well, not the left side, the right side. And I became an artist. Though I'm getting mixed up now. Which side of the brain?
That's right. You're right. Yeah. Right side would have been,
More art?
The right is expressed on the left, but it is, your right is usually left brain. Left brain is logic, right brain is creativity.
But I became an artist.
Yeah.
I had lots of trouble writing.
Yeah.
And, even as a kid. And I didn't know this till I began to get interested in medicine, going into medicine as a profession and finding papers in our house from the hospitals. And I suddenly realized there wasn't a single photograph of me until I found one where it said Bernie, age 7. And I'm sitting in a carriage like half a mile away where you don't even know who it is and what he looks like. And so I finally began to talk to my mother, and she said, I had Graves' disease, severe hyperthyroidism, and the doctors all told me, don't become pregnant, it could kill you. But my mother said to me, I want a grandchild. And my crazy mother became pregnant to make her mother happy.
Wow.
And that's when I began to hear the story. We both could have died. I mean, she was in labor for months.
Yeah,
not just weeks. They told her, you're not going to get him out. Your body's too depleted. Let me just say this. When I saw the pictures of her that they hadn't thrown away, she looked like somebody who had just escaped from a concentration camp. Big bulging eyes, totally, devoid body, just bones, no muscles. And then I began to realize what she was saying.
Yeah, and
I said, Mom, if you gave birth to a baby and they didn't know what to do with me, she said, you were not a child. You were a purple melon. Those are exact words. So we put you in a carriage and covered it to hide you. Or we hid you in a crib in the house with a blanket over it, so nobody could see you and get upset. You know, because if a neighbor heard, oh, you had a new baby, can I see it? The answer is no. I said, then I should have died, Ma, because you can't do that to a newborn infant or kitten. It everything turns off and it dies. Metabolism never gets going.
Yeah.
How come I didn't die? And this sentence I hear in my head all the time. Oh, my mother took you, poured oil all over you, and pushed everything back where it belonged 4 and 5 times a day.
Wow.
Every time they go in and try to feed me, my grandmother would pour oil all over me and push everything back where it belonged.
Wow.
And let me tell you, that's in my body too.
Yeah.
Every time I tell that story, I'm 40 years of age. Yeah. Have had multiple massages by men.
Yeah.
One day, our therapist says to my wife and I can't do both of you today. I'm so busy. But my wife's a therapist. Can she do one of you? I said, we love your coarse hands, but let your wife do me because I don't want to deprive my wife of your massage. I lay down on a table, you know, clothes off. The wife comes over, starts putting her hands on. I could feel it happening to me. I went into a trance. Remember, I'm oiled. A woman's hands rubbing all over me.
Yeah, of course.
Went back to being an infant.
Yeah.
And she thought I'd had a stroke or something because she said this. She said to me later, she said, I didn't know what happened to you because I would say, turn over, raise your right arm, and you never moved. Labia. So I thought you had a stroke or a heart attack.
Wow.
And so everybody in the building, in a sense, who was getting massaged or doing something, came to the room to stare at me because they didn't know. They'd all heard there's somebody down there who probably had a stroke and he's lying on the table. And when she stopped talking to me, though, I gradually began to come back into my brain. And I suddenly awakened. See, I wasn't upset because I knew what had happened. I became an infant again.
Yeah,
I knew I went
you,
into.
You went back in that.
Yeah, but I didn't know what else was going on in the room.
Yeah,
you know. Then I could think, wow, she could have passed out. Thinking, what have I done to him? And I said, "What are you all doing here? I'm getting massaged." And they said, "We thought you had a heart attack or a stroke. You didn't respond to us. We couldn't talk to you."
Interesting.
And I said, yeah, I got to tell you a story. I went into a trance. Yeah. It was my grandmother massaging me. And I went back to being an infant. But that taught me a hell of a lot about our mind and our body and the memories we store. You know, and I began to understand it with patients, too. Where you touch them, how you touch them, the parts of their body that they had diseases in, that, you know, it's not all coincidence.
Well, and, Bernie, were you trained as an MD at that point?
When? What do you mean?
When, you know, when during this period we're talking about, you know, after, you know, during this massage, when you went into the, you know, the trance.
Oh, yeah, I was a doctor by then.
Yeah, you were a doctor at the time. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was, I'd say, in my 40s.
Okay, so this really opened you up and changed maybe the way you saw the world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I couldn't deny what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't going to. I talked about it. A lot of people thought I was nuts, but that didn't bother me. I just thought, if that's in me, think of what's in other people too. So I began to deal with them in that way. And that's why I got involved in things like drawings, you know, even the effect of massage, how people were touched, the memories it brought back. So it's a whole new world that began to come into my life. And I was considered crazy at the hospital.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Because everybody wanted to talk to me who was considered crazy.
Yeah.
The patients would page me. Can I talk to you. Can you come to my room, please? Everybody thinks I'm crazy. Why? Let me just give you that one example. I don't know if I've
talked about it. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, a woman said, I had a heart-lung transplant, and the man whose heart and lungs are in me came to me last night and said, hey, my heart and lungs are in you, and we're going to have breakfast together, so I want to tell you what I want for breakfast tomorrow. And, you know, every time she said something to some, they all said, oh, that's crazy. Stop telling us this. And so she paged me. And I said, okay, next time, ask him if he can give you his phone number for his family. We'll call them. And she had the phone number the next day. And we called. And they said, yes, his heart lungs are in her. He died in a motorcycle accident. Guess what she had done for the first time in her life? Taking a motorcycle ride. And those are the things. And she wrote a book called The Change of Heart by Claire Sylvia. Anybody wants to look it up? It was published several years ago. But that's why everybody wanted to talk to me. Because if they're considered crazy, we can talk to him. He won't call us crazy. He'll listen and see what he can establish and do with this. So I got involved in drawings and talking to people while they were anesthetized, doing all kinds. I called it lying to people, though that upset our children. We have five.
Yeah.
Because I did a lot of children's surgery, and I knew I could hypnotize them because I was a doctor and they believed in me. So I walk in with an alcohol sponge and say, don't worry, you won't feel any more needles. I'm going to rub your skin wherever you're supposed to get an injection, and your skin will be numb and you won't feel the needles. And what did almost every kid say to me? Why don't the other doctors use those?
Oh, wow.
It was amazing.
Wow.
But you see, that's how I changed the hospital, because they couldn't call me crazy if a kid said, oh, that's good, I didn't feel that. And they would think, what do you mean you didn't feel it? Well, Dr. Siegel said, it's going to numb my skin. And so everybody realized, as crazy as I was doing a lot of good things for kids.
So would you say that the doctors actually got the mind-body connection after you were there? I mean, some of them probably did. Realizing the importance of the mind.
Yeah, you see, doctors are not trained to treat people. Because of my life, I got involved caring for people, not treating diseases. So I'm saying this all the time. I don't know if I've been on your show before and said it, but you ask your doctor. I would tell this to every patient, every medical school. When somebody applies for a medical degree, say, send in a drawing of yourself working as a doctor with your application. And if you go to see your doctor in the near future, say, would you draw a picture for me? Use a pencil if you want to, if you're working as a doctor. 90% don't show a patient. Equipment, desks, records, you know, everything, but no patient. That blew my mind when I learned that. I can't remember who told me that was what was happening. With somebody who, you know, therapist who was doing this. But first time I actually did it was with 90 medical students. 9 out of 90 had a patient in the picture.
Wow. Wow.
I couldn't believe it. The others are all doing things.
Yeah. So what it's sharing is that they're a pretty self-centered, not patient-centered, which is...
Right, they're treating a disease. So here's a prescription, go take these pills.
Yeah.
They don't say, what's going on in your life? Why do you think you're sick now? See, that's what turned me over. As I said, I keep telling the same stories. So if I've said things to you, you can always interrupt me. But what I began to do is start support groups for patients.
Yeah,
that was my next shock. I said to my secretary in our surgical office, because I worked with other guys, so we had a big practice. I said, send out letters to all our cancer patients saying, if you want to come to a meeting, Dr. Siegel's going to run a support group for cancer patients. Now, I expected, you know, like 150 people would show up because the secretary sent out way more letters than I wanted her to send. I said to her, I don't know what I'm going to do with all these people. I go to the first meeting, and my wife came with me. I walk in the door to the room expecting a mob. I said to my wife, oh, my God, there's only 9 women here. And my wife's quote, Bernie, they're exceptional women. I said, honey, you've named the group. We're going to call them exceptional cancer patients.
I love that.
And that group is still running years later. Other people have started groups with that name.
Let me ask you, because this is, I think, important to people that'll be watching this. Bernie, what, I mean, how important was, you know, in these support groups using like guided imagery or visualization or, you know, helping them release their emotional traumas, you know, what happened in these groups?
Oh, this is what kept me going.
Yeah.
I told people in my office, and sometimes others in the support group, if somebody in your family dies who I've been taking care of, call me. I'd like to come to the funeral to show my respect and that I cared about them. And I couldn't believe how few phone calls I was getting from people who stopped coming to the office, stopped coming to support groups. I thought, why didn't they call me? So what do? I started pulling out their records and calling the numbers that were in it. And who do you think answered?
Probably the husband.
The person I was dead answered the phone. And the first time it happened, I just busted out laughing and changed my whole approach. I call up and I hear his voice. I said, oh my God, I thought you were dead. I found your cell phone number in my chart, so I called. He said, no, Bernie, I moved to Arizona. It was either Arizona or Colorado. I think it was Arizona. He said, I found this beautiful place in the mountains, and it was just so pretty. I thought, I'm going to stay here and die here. He said, but then I realized I'm not dying while I was staying there. And this is 4 years later, and he was alive and well.
Yeah.
And so that's what I began to realize. I need to teach people, do what makes you happy. And if you have time for one more story, I'm giving a talk to cancer patients at an elaborate church in Manhattan. So I'm well-dressed and want to impress everybody. And as I get up on the stage and walk up to the podium to begin, I hear something behind me. I turn around, and there's a bum. I thought, oh, my God, some drug addict has wandered in off the street, and he's looking for help by the church. So I said to him, excuse me, I'm here to give a lecture. I can't help you right now. Go downstairs. Go to the priest's office. They'll find somebody to talk to you to help you with your problem. He said, no, I came here to listen to you. I don't have a problem with drugs. He said, I have a problem with cancer, so I came to listen to you. I said, why do you look like this? He said, oh, when I learned I had cancer, I changed my life. He said, I was a multimillionaire. I wanted to impress everybody, so I dressed in immaculate, you know, expensive clothing. All my employees did. Our office looked fantastic. I wanted everybody who came in the door to realize, oh, my God, they're making a fortune. I'll do business with them. But then when I thought, oh, I'm going to be dead in this short time, what the hell? I'm not going to worry about what the office looks like. So I just started wearing old, relaxed clothing, and I noticed something. I didn't die when I thought I was supposed to. And I mean it. He really, you wouldn't believe what he looked like.
So would you say, Bernie, you know, I got to take a break here because I got to do a commercial. I got to get paid here. We'll be right back. But when we come back from the break here, I have a question. You know, hope and belief, you know, I know you use this. Can this really change lives? So just pause for a second. We'll be right back and we'll answer that question in just a moment here.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
So, Bernie, I was talking about, you know, hope and belief. They can change outcomes. You know, a lot of people go, oh, that's woo-woo. That'll never happen. If I just believe I'm going to heal, I'm going to heal, I'm going to heal, it doesn't happen. But what was your experience with working with people?
I think they're really following their heart. I don't remember who said these things, but let your heart make up your mind. You know what I mean? That when you're really in touch with feelings, yeah. Well, the part that impressed me, about 6 years or maybe it's 8 years now, my wife had multiple diseases that I not how to survive all of them. And I mean, things like multiple sclerosis or breast cancer, a million things. And I remember one of her doctors saying to me, she's not going to see her kids grow up. I felt like hitting him in the head with a baseball bat. I said, you don't say that to a patient. And she lived to see every kid grow up and a whole bunch of, you know, grandkids. But one day I go in, I used to have nurses come in the morning and spend the day with her. So I go into the bedroom and I go over to wake her up because she's still lying under the cover. And I take her hand and it's ice cold. And I realize she had died in her sleep. Well, within seconds, I had a heart attack. And to describe it, I felt like somebody took this ragged blade and plunged it into my back, right into my heart. The pain was incredible. And I thought, I may drop dead right here with what's happening. But I just stopped, sat down, and my wife is always there for me. I know she saved my life. It quieted down. The nurses showed up, helped me, helped everything. And yes, I then had trouble with my heart, some rhythm problems, and I've got a pacemaker now. But what I found so freaking fascinating was how that emotion in seconds gave me a heart attack. Wow. I'd been running marathons. You know, I'm 92.
Right.
And I was in such excellent shape, you know, you'd say, how do you have a heart attack when you're running marathons? Yeah. But I did because of the loss of my loved one. Yeah. And that's the part I've learned about our bodies. And so, again, when I'm talking about people who didn't die when they were supposed to, they changed their feelings and they became happy. And then their inner chemistry changed and their body responded and they didn't die. And it was absolutely incredible. And
so, you know,
these mystical things, because my wife was born on 9/9 and 9 days after she died, I got the message to go to the emergency room to be checked on. I walked into the emergency room and I haven't even signed in. And a voice, I don't know who yelled it, yells, put him in room 9. Then the guy comes over to me and says, you have to be admitted to the hospital to evaluate your heart. And all the beds are filled. There's only one room open. The number is 819. Everything, my wristband, you know, the wristband you put on, I usually have some lying around here, but it's not in the room with me. But the wristband, I started saying to people, look at this. And they said, leave us alone. We know it's all about nines and your wife. Because my wristband would be like 81996633, or it had 11s, which is the day we were married. I mean, It made absolutely no sense to me that these things could be coincidences.
Yeah.
everything made me think my wife was here.
Yeah.
And let me say this. I mean, it hadn't stopped.
Yeah.
Because the other morning, I don't know whether, I think it was yesterday, I got a message. Open your eyes, see what time it is. And it was 10:14. That's my birthday, October 14th. I opened my eyes in the middle of the night. Look at the clock, 10:14. I said, thanks, honey. And so I see these things happening all the time around the house.
Wow.
Numbers popping up everywhere.
So, Bernie, that leads me to believe, you know, let me ask you two things. You're 92. So why are we here? What have you learned? Who were you before we came here? Who are we after we leave here? You know, you've had a lot of experience with this.
Yeah, we are spirits too, but we're given a body to accomplish something. If you were just a spirit, what are you going to do? And let me tell you what happened again to me. I went to a workshop, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She said to everybody in the room, look off in, you know, the landscape around us, and you'll see somebody standing there. And I look out, and I thought, this is ridiculous. I didn't come here for this crazy stuff. You know, she's telling us we'll meet an inner guide. So look for a path and somebody standing there. But I saw somebody. And he looked rather weird because he had something black on his head and white on his shoulders.
Right.
And I don't know why he was dressed that way. But we were told to ask his name. And he said, yes, my name is George. And I was very disappointed. I'm looking for, you know, an angel, right. Jesus, right. Somebody special. I have to say, I can't remember how often he would appear, maybe in something I was doing or notice him. I was speaking at a Christian funeral. And when I had done speaking, everybody got up, going to their cars, driving to the cemetery. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross knew the guy and was there at the meeting, at this funeral. And she came over to me and said, Bernie. I said, what is it, Elizabeth? Are you Jewish? I said, what are you asking me that for? Because I spoke at a Christian funeral. No, there's a rabbi standing next to you.
Uh-huh.
And she described George in complete detail. I said, yeah, Elizabeth, his name is George. Now I know what's on his head. It's his prayer cap and his prayer shawls. Now all those things I thought were weird, you know, seeing him from a distance, I realized it's all part of his religion and mine. And I can tell you one more thing, and it doesn't matter whether all the people listening think I'm crazy or not. George has saved my life more than once. Yeah. He told me he saved me. I don't know how he got assigned to me. I think it probably had something to do with my grandfather who taught Judaism in Russia and my parents. But anyway, he said, because I remember this. I had a near-death experience, and I'm 3.5 years old. And I knew I was 3.5 because I left my body, and I saw my mother, pregnant, walking towards me to come and get me because I was outdoors, and I was playing with a toy, and I aspirated it and was choking to death. And then suddenly, I felt everything come flying out and somebody squeezing me. And later, when I could talk to George, he said, yeah, you aren't supposed to die when you're 3.5. So I did an Heimlich maneuver and get it to pop out. It was pieces of a toy because men were working in our house. I wasn't being stupid. I was imitating a bunch of carpenters who were putting nails in their mouth and, you know, doing work because they didn't have automatic tools in those days. So I was playing a game and I thought I'll imitate building something. And I put these things in my mouth, may believe they were nails, but I aspirated them with choking to death.
So you think a lot. You think we all have guides? Do you think we have guides?
We may, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't say we don't. Yeah. But the what was the other thing? Yeah, so I knew he'd save me then. Oh, I remember now. This is what really woke me up and made me a believer. I live on a, well, with five kids, we have a lot of rooms in the house. It's shaped like a big C.
Yeah.
And a tree branch, a great big one, crashed onto the roof. Fortunately, it didn't punch a hole or anything, but I put a ladder up, went up, and thought, I'll just drag it and throw it off on the ground. Then we can clean it up. So I throw the tree down. Then I stepped onto the ladder, and the top rung of the ladder broke. And I'm falling straight down. But then I suddenly realized, how come you didn't get caught in the ladder? How come you're not tumbling down? It felt like you would pick up a child and put it somewhere.
Yeah.
That's how I felt. Somebody's carrying me. I'm straight up and down, going down. And I realized, yeah, it's George. He's saving your life. My feet hit the ground a little hard. So I lost my balance, but I didn't get hurt. You know, I just sort of fell over. And the family came running out. Call the ambulance! Call the ambulance! I said, what are you calling an ambulance for? I'm fine. They looked at me like, what? You just fell off the roof and you're fine? But so George,
you're talking about it, but a lot of us have those experiences. And I think that it's time to bring that to consciousness, that there are beings that are watching over our safety. We, you know, I can't tell you then whoever's watching over
some of us are fortunate enough to have a guardian angel.
Yeah.
I don't know if it may be that everybody does, but a lot of us may not relate to our guardian angel or connect. And maybe our angel gives up, stop being our guardian. But what I began to notice was, George, it's not just about my life. He would take over lectures for me too. Now I'm doing the talking, not him. But I knew those were things that I hadn't planned to say. And then people began to show up after my lectures, and they most of them were about 2 hours. They'd come up and say, there was a man standing in front of you by the podium, so I drew his picture for you. And I said, oh, yes, that's George. And it's because things would come into my lectures that I had not put in my outline. And at first I thought, where the hell did that come from? Why did I say that? But then I realized it's George. And especially when people come up and say, there was somebody standing in front of you.
Yeah.
I knew. I didn't have to worry about it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, I got to take a quick break. When we do get back, I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about, the consciousness of health. You know, what is that consciousness that people need to really hold on to when they're trying to heal any disease? So we're going to take a break, and I'll be right back with Dr. Bernie Siegel.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Well, welcome back, everybody. This is your host, Candy Foster, and I'm talking with Dr. Bernie Siegel. Today, we're talking about healing. We're talking about consciousness. We're talking about things that a lot of people don't talk about. You know, we just talked about spiritual guides and our guardian angels and how they impact our life and how they can impact your life and your healing when you become more and more aware. There are certain things in this world that dumb you down, but there are certain things that awaken you and open you up to remember that brilliance, that soul that's inside of you. And Dr. Siegel has that in spades. People are suffering. They're going through a lot of challenges in their health these days. There's so many chemicals and environmental challenges and just all kinds of stuff happening that are hurting people.
How do I just say
what
this?
Is consciousness of health?
You've got to believe in yourself. You know? So you can get up and say what's true for you and stop worrying what everybody else is saying. Now, I didn't worry about it, but then I noticed when I would, because people would call and say, can I interview you? Fine. See, when you call and say, can I have you on my show? I don't say, I wonder what he's going to say about me. So I would just say yes to people. And then I would see the article come out in some major magazines all across the country. Interview with the controversial Dr. Bernie Seelaw. And the only person who would read the article and say, I read a lovely article about you. I'd say, Ma, did you really read that article? My mother was the only one who could read these things and think she still had a wonderful son. Because everything I talked about, like I said to you, I could have a near-death experience. Oh, that's crazy. You can't, you know. And, you know, doing drawings with patients and seeing what's going on inside their body. The doctors don't take care of people, and I get criticized by everybody, you know, near-death experiences. But see, the things, again, that I heard people tell me, other people didn't know about. Oh, I mean, all the things that converted the hospital, when I started working with drawings, and as I said, I did a lot of children's surgery, and the kids didn't worry if they were an artist or not. So I'd say, here, draw yourself in the operating room. You know, draw yourself taking your treatment for cancer. And then I could help their parents see what was good for them, what was going to be a problem, how we could alter their thinking and get them to not have all the side effects. And when other doctors saw that and patients, they began to realize Siegel's not crazy. So literally, in the outpatient surgery department at Yale, they made a coloring book for all the children I was operating on, and other kids too, when they learned how to interpret the drawings. They would come in, they'd be given a five little pages, and say, here's a box of crayons, draw yourself on all, draw, fill in. I mean, they had to draw themselves. It's like you come in, you meet the anesthesiologist, you know, your parents bring you to the operating room and all that until you're done and come out and meet your parents again. Well, one page, because this really shook everybody up and made them a believer, said you meet someone called an anesthesiologist who's dressed in an outfit that looks like green pajamas. The kid drew him in red.
Yeah.
When I saw that, because the anesthesiologist came running out to me with it and said, Bernie, look, they knew red was a danger sign. I said, look at the last page. If he draws himself purple, a spiritual color, he's telling me I'm dying in the operating room. I'm just sending him home. The last page didn't. It showed I'm going home unhappy. And so we went ahead with the procedure. But the fascinating thing was, Bernie, I was really worried because his mother has muscular dystrophy, which meant if he had some of her muscle genes, he could have an adverse reaction to muscle relaxants that we give these, you know, patients, and he could have died as a adverse reaction to them. And that's why it changed everybody at the hospital, because Siegel isn't crazy anymore. Look what he does. Look what he sees. Look what his patients are sharing. So it opened people's minds. That doesn't mean everything's changed there. I mean, if I'm not there and sharing stories, things go back. But I have patients. Let me say one more thing. One more thing. I had some patients who were mystics because they didn't mind coming to see me and really be able to talk to me about themselves. And they communicated with dead patients. And I started getting phone calls from them. After some of my patients died, these mystics would call me and say, oh, I have a message for you, Bernie, from one of your patients. They came to me and told me to get in touch with you and tell you they're okay. And one of them, that couldn't be a coincidence, Bernie, a lovely lady got in touch with me this morning. She died last night. It was my mother-in-law. She had just died. And she said, Barney, she apparently had been an opera singer. She had a lovely voice. That was my mother-in-law. And she said she wanted to tell you everything's okay, she's fine, and thank you for everything.
Oh.
Now, you know, how could anybody know all that if all this stuff wasn't true?
Right.
So I say to people, again, the biggest thing is to enjoy your life. You know, enjoy who you are, what you're doing. And again, it's the people that taught me these things. People who'd had polio and lost the use of their legs, but still loved living and were doing things for people. So they all became my teachers. It wasn't you had to be perfect and everything had to be all right. You could be blind and think the world is fine.
Well, I've got to wrap it up. We're just about out of time, but I want to reiterate your message and then give you a final comment, because I think the message is this. It's that, you know, we're talking about living authentically, you know, living joyfully, aligned with your true self. And if you do that, you can improve your health. And, you know, really expressing your emotions, follow the passions, and, you know, stop suppressing what your emotions are and who you are. And if you do, life can get better, no matter, like you just said, you've gone through a terrible experience, but you know what? There's still reason to live. There's still passion here. There's ways to heal yourself emotionally, mentally, and then enjoy your life no matter what's going on. That's my message. What's your final thoughts, Bernie?
Never run out of time. Use your time. See, those are the people who didn't die. When I'm running out of time and I think I'm going to die, I started enjoying myself, and then I didn't die when I was supposed to. You can't believe how many times I burst out laughing, calling up to say, why wasn't I invited to the funeral? And I knew who answered the phone. It was somebody who didn't die.
That's funny. All right, well, we got to go. I want to thank everybody for joining me again on another one of my shows here for Heal It. Please share this show with your family and friends and those that you want to help them heal, help them grow, and help them evolve. Take care.